Tonight we are going to study the 33rd chapter of Isaiah. This 33rd chapter of Isaiah is a prophecy kind of off to itself, although it is about the same subject or similar subject that we've had prophesied before in the earlier chapters of Isaiah. This chapter is primarily about, again, the besieging of the city of Jerusalem by the Assyrian army led by Sennacherib. And it may seem like, well, we're getting a little bit tired of that subject because we're having it over and over here in Isaiah, but each time he looks at it from a different viewpoint and he tells us some aspects of it, and we learn some lessons as a result that we didn't learn in the other prophecies. In this chapter, we have a transition several times. Sometimes he's talking about the people in Jerusalem. Sometimes he's talking about the army of the Assyrians. Sometimes he's talking about what God thinks and proclaims that he will do. And even there's a time or two in here which it looks like Isaiah is talking as though he is a spectator looking upon this scene. In the first verse, this is Isaiah 33, he begins by saying, "Woe to thee that spoileth, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee." Here he's talking to the Assyrian army. And this army was guilty of spoiling and of dealing treacherously. Now, they weren't defending themselves. They weren't doing this as a result of a provocation. He says, "Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled." These people in Jerusalem didn't do you any damage. They didn't attack you or threaten you or deprive you of anything. You weren't spoiled, but yet you spoiled. "And dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee." Assyrian government, as we're going to see, had actually... violated a covenant or an implied covenant that they had with Jerusalem. They dealt treacherously. They said one thing and did another. And today, as we study wars, we see that in most cases, there is one army that spoils and has not been spoiled, and that deals treacherously and has not been dealt treacherously with. And in the intrigue of national power and defense and wars and so forth, there is always some kind of treacherous dealing and some kind of spoiling. War wouldn't be war without spoiling. That is, taking goods and either destroying those goods or depriving the original owner of them and using them for your own purpose. So he says, "When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled, and when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee." Now, there's coming a time, as he speaks to this army, there's coming a time in which you're going to cease to spoil. That is, when God destroys you, when you no longer have any power, you're going to cease to spoil, and then you're going to be spoiled. And thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously. There's coming a time when you won't deal treacherously anymore, and they shall deal treacherously with thee. Now, speaking of they dealing treacherously with thee, he doesn't necessarily mean that the people in Jerusalem would deal treacherously, but he means that the force of them, which includes Almighty God himself, will deal treacherously with thee. That is, you're going to have the same kind of treatment given to you that you have given to others. And as you look back in the course of history at all the wars, it nearly always happens this way. The country that deals treacherously and the country that spoils, there usually comes a time in which they themselves are spoiled and they themselves are dealt treacherously with. And in this particular case, though, of Jerusalem, it was a matter of God being their defender, their protector, and their champion. God was the one who was going to take these matters into his own hands. Now, were we in the position of these Jewish people in Jerusalem, as this great Assyrian force was bearing down upon them, we might wonder, how would we feel? To whom would we turn? Well, we've already seen that they turned to Egypt, and it didn't do them any good. Egypt couldn't help them. If we were worshiping idolatrous God, certainly that wouldn't do us any good. To whom would we turn? Well, those who knew the truth and who had enough belief in God to turn to God, of course, this would have been the ideal time to do so. So in verse 2, we have the Jews offering a prayer to God. And it goes like this: O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. So it begins by saying, O Lord, be gracious unto us. That is, Lord, we want your grace. To be gracious is to give grace, or to give undeserved or unearned favor. Be gracious unto us. In this particular case, it was save us from the destruction of our city. Be thou, we have waited for thee. Now, to pray to God and say we have waited for thee means that we have been patient in allowing your will to come about. We're depending upon you. We're following the course of events as you have prescribed them for us. We're not taking matters into our own hands. We're not acting presumptuously. We're not acting in haste or in a rash manner, but we're waiting for you. And it gives us some thought here as to when we pray that we certainly ought to be able to say, we have waited for thee. Then he says, be thou their arm every morning. And this is a confusing phrase here because he says their arm. The word arm would mean strength or support or sustenance. Be thou their arm. And some of the writers feel that Isaiah, in recording this prayer, kind of is standing alone now, and he is praying it as though it's he praying for the other people of Jerusalem, because in the very next breath he says, our salvation also in the time of trouble. And it's just simply a matter of calling upon God to be their arm or their strength, our salvation. Our salvation would mean our means or our source of being saved, also in the time of trouble. Certainly these people could have appropriately prayed this prayer and referred to it as being in the time of trouble. But how many, many times do we find ourselves approaching God and the basic theme of our need is in the time of trouble? It seems this is just the history of man, to find himself continually in a condition that he can call in the time of trouble. Here it was actual a threat to their civilization, their nation, their very lives. But there are many things that could fall into this category of in the time of trouble. There could be family problems. There could be sickness or a death in the family. There could be mental conflicts. There could be financial troubles. Many, many problems, religious problems, in which we would be approaching God in the time of trouble. And so we see this is an appropriate time to go to God, although it's not the only time we go to God. And verse 3, God is declaring the overthrow of this army of Sennacherib. He says, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. Now this is a picture of God then, as he turned on this army. He says, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. And in chapter 29, verse 6, in describing God's attack upon this army, thou shalt be visited of the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake, and great noise with storm and tempest and the flame of devouring fire. So he says the noise of tumult. There was some kind of a commotion that could be called a tumult. And certainly when we think of thunder and earthquake and great noise and storm and tempest and the flame of devouring fire, we think of the noise of tumult. Again, in chapter 30, verse 30, "And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lightning down of his arm, with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones." So we don't have to use our imagination now when he says the noise of the tumult. The people fled, speaking of the great Assyrian army. "At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered." And we've shown before how that this army of the Assyrians was made up of various nationalities who were subservient to the Assyrian power and pressed into service into their army. So the nations were scattered. "And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar, as the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them." Now, your spoil would be the goods of warfare that this army had confiscated during their onslaught. But he says, after the Lord gets through with you, that your spoil shall be scattered like the gathering of the caterpillar, as the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. Now, this is a little hard to interpret this, but the caterpillar and the locust were eaten in those days, and so one figure here is would be of the gathering up of these insects and piling them into piles. They used to rake them into ditches, they say, and then when they needed them, they'd have them to eat. Or it could also be depicting the picture of these insects as they go to and fro gathering food for themselves, going in a helter-skelter manner, no necessary order about it. That may be what he's saying here. This is the way your spoil is going to be scattered, just like the locust as they run to and fro. Beginning in verse 5, we have a verse that gives praise to God. "The Lord is exalted." Now, this seems to be a result of God's overthrow of this army. "The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness." There's never a time in which we could say that the Lord shouldn't or couldn't be exalted. It is always appropriate to look upon the Lord as being exalted. And the reasons he gives here is, number one is, "For he dwelleth on high." Just to be in this vicinity of what is called on high here lends a certain amount of exalting to a being. We cannot imagine anything in the vicinity of where the Lord dwells as being evil or being from Satan. Just to be in the vicinity of the Lord. You know, we think of the angels and we think of the living creatures and the 24 elders and anything in that area, all as being highly exalted and holy creatures. Well, that's one of the reasons then that the Lord is continually exalted, for he dwells there. He dwells on high. "He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness." So rather than allowing Zion to be destroyed, he's filled it with judgment and righteousness. Now, he didn't save it to be a wicked city. He didn't want it to survive just for its own useless gains, but he filled it with righteousness and judgment. Now, as we think of righteousness, it means right doing, doing that which is right. As we think of judgment, we think of it being the decrees, the laws that determine what is proper and what's not proper. Well, the Lord filled his people, his city, this place called Zion, with that. Then in verse 6, "And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation." Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. That was true during the time of Jerusalem. It's true during our times today. These two things, wisdom and knowledge. As we know, knowledge happens to be the facts that we get through learning, through study, and wisdom is the ability to make application of those facts. And we learn very plainly in the first chapter of James that if any man lack knowledge, wisdom, he is to pray to God who gives freely, and he'll give him this knowledge, this wisdom, the ability to apply the facts. Now, it would be rather useless for us to pray to God for wisdom if we didn't have the facts, didn't have anything to make an application of. So it implies that we must study, we must work on our part before we're in a position to have God to give us wisdom. I could know ever so much about how to apply an obscure prophecy from the Old Testament, but if I never heard the prophecy, if I never studied it, didn't even know what it said, my knowledge of how to apply it wouldn't do me one bit of good if God even gave it to me. Because it must be coupled with these facts. But he says, wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. I like the wording of that. I suppose that ever since Adam and Eve fell from the Garden of Eden, they have felt, man has felt as though we live in troublesome, unstable times. We feel it in our generation. I'm sure every other generation has been able to say with a truthful feeling that we live in unstable times. But the one thing that happens to be the stability of the times is this combination of wisdom and knowledge. It is that which allows us to look on at the great scene of events and to have an objective viewpoint and to say, yes, this is following the pattern of so-and-so, and we can have even a prediction as to what may or may not happen, and to know how we are to act and to react as a result of the events that are common to us today. And that is the stability of the times. We're not tossed to and fro by every cunning craftiness of men or every wind of doctrine. We're not unstable. We have a stability. Not riches or wealth or power, but he says wisdom and knowledge are the stability of thy times. And truly it was, in the case of these people in Jerusalem, had they just known God's prophecies, that this punishment that they were receiving was because of their unfaithfulness to God, that God would save them, that God had promised that he would, then look how much more stable they could have been as a result of their wisdom and knowledge. So wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times and strength of salvation. So it would be the very strength of, the very source of their salvation. And I want you to know this, there's no way that we can be saved without wisdom and knowledge. If we don't know what God wants us to do, we cannot be saved. There is no strength of salvation. Salvation has no power for us at all. And then he concludes by saying, the fear of the Lord is his treasure. Now some want to attribute this sixth verse to the king of Hezekiah. That Hezekiah was the one who had the Lord as his treasure and who had the wisdom and knowledge and so on. And it may be that it could be attributed to Hezekiah, who was the king of Jerusalem at that time, but I think that it's a more general application than that. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. What is our treasure? Is our treasure the fear of the Lord? Is that the one thing that we have a storehouse full of? And here we're speaking of the reverence and deep feeling for the Lord. Do we have a storehouse full of the fear of the Lord? Is that our treasure? Now in verse 7, he begins to show the despair and the alarm of the Jews shown at the approach of this army of Sennacherib. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. And I think before we go further with this passage, let's look at situation so we can see what this is talking about. In 2 Kings 18, beginning with the 14th verse, the king of Jerusalem, Hezekiah, had made a real hard effort at having peace with Assyria. And he'd even made an agreement and carried out his part of the agreement, and it all came to nothing. In the 14th verse, "And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish," and this was a city that the army had progressed to, "saying, I have offended. Return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria." So we see that Hezekiah had made a real valiant effort to appease this king of Assyria. And this 18th chapter of Kings, or 2 Kings, we could go on and read more of it. But the king of Assyria sent his ambassadors down and just made all kinds of fun. They ridiculed him for serving God. This king of Assyria said, "Well, we have defeated all these other nations and their gods didn't help any. And here you've come in, Hezekiah, and you've torn down these idols and these groves, and you think God's still going to help you?" And what Hezekiah had really done, he tore down the idols, all right, which were the no gods, the false gods, and he was ribbed by the king of Assyria for having torn them down because he accused him of offending his own God, of offending the God of Hezekiah. And so it's a long chapter, and a lot of interesting things are said there, but all the ambassadors' contact and all of the planning and agreements and the payment of this gold and silver had been for nothing. It was 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So as we see back in our 33rd chapter of Isaiah, "Behold, the valiant one shall cry without, the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly." It had all been for nothing. The valiant ones are the ones who were trying to save the nation, who were trying to deal with these people and showing strength and courage and so on. They cried without. That is, they cried outside of the limits of the city, I would think it means, as they were on their mission. They saw that it was in vain. "The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly." They were trying to make peace and were not able to do so. "The highways lie waste, the wayfaring man ceaseth, he hath broken the covenant, he hath despised the cities, he regards no man." Highways lie waste would mean that nobody was doing any unnecessary traveling now on the highways because the country was at war, it was besieged. "The wayfaring man ceaseth," that there's not anybody who's traveling, there's no wayfarer anymore because it's too dangerous to travel. "He hath broken the covenant," that is, the covenant that was made or at least implied by Assyria with these people of Jerusalem. He broke the covenant. "He had despised the cities. And at the time he laid siege to the city of Jerusalem, he had conquered about 46 walled cities, all of the walled cities of Judah. He regardeth no man." He made mockery of Hezekiah. He didn't have any kind of respect for anybody, any man. "The earth mourneth and languisheth." So here's another picture now of as the covenant was broken, the highways were laid waste, there was no wayfaring man, the ambassadors were of peace were weeping bitterly as this was happening, then he says, "The earth mourneth and languisheth." This is no doubt a figurative term here, but it could also have a lot of literal aspects to it. In times of war, some of the most outstanding pictures that I can remember of warfare is the destruction of the cities and of the countryside. It's not a time for planting and growing and harvesting crops. It's not a time for raising cattle. It's not a time for any productive thing, it seems. in the land. So the earth mourneth and languisheth. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Now Lebanon was known for its tall cedar trees. And so he describes Lebanon as being a place that has all the trees cut out now. It's hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness. Sharon was an area that was located just south of Mount Carmel and extended all the way down to Philippi and Caesarea. And it was called the Plain of Sharon, and it was a very fertile and fruitful area. We read of the Rose of Sharon, and that was primarily the area known as Sharon. There's another place over east of the Jordan River also known as Sharon. But he says Sharon is like a wilderness. And Bashan. Now Bashan was a place, you know, we read about it in Amos and also earlier in Isaiah. Bashan was east of the Jordan River also. I believe it was located in part of the half tribe of Manasseh over there. And it was noted for its pasture land and large oak trees and being a fruitful area. And so he says, Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Carmel, of course, was Mount Carmel, and it no doubt had some fruitful areas about it. So the earth mourns and languishes as a result of this. But beginning in verse 10, we have a promise given by God now that he will interpose, that he will interfere with the plans of this Assyrian army, and he'll change it. So he says, "Now will I rise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself." That is, the Lord is going to come now as a force that has risen up, that has been exalted, that has lifted itself up against this offending army. Ye shall conceive chaff. Ye shall bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you. Now this is a real powerful little verse, I think. Ye shall conceive. To conceive something means that there's been a coming together and a reproduction of something. Well, their conceivings here is described as chaff. It's nothing. It's of no value. Chaff and stubble is always looked upon in the Bible as things of no value. Things to be destroyed, things to be blown away by the wind, things that are not kept because of the fact that they're not valuable. Well, all of their planning and their conniving and their decisions and their power would come to nothing. You shall conceive chaff. They were planning on bringing forth a big victory here, but they were going to have chaff. Ye shall bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you. Now this word here, breath, really means spirit. And some want to translate it as his breath or my breath, speaking of God. But it doesn't say that. It says your breath. And what it probably means is your spirit, your thoughts, the mind that you have as an offending force against God's people shall, as a fire, shall devour you. That is, your own thoughts, your own plans are going to be the thing that's going to be your undoing. It's going to devour you. And the people shall be as the burnings of lime. And the burnings of lime is picture of a foundry or a hot furnace that was lined with the substance known as lime so that the fire would be contained in it. And so it would be like the burnings of lime. As thorns cut up, shall they be burned in the fire. When you think of thorns and cutting them up and putting them in the fire, that's what he says is going to be the result of your siege of the city of Jerusalem. Hear, ye that are far off, what I have done, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might. This is an announcement by God to the nations. He tells these nations, ye that are far off, hear what I've done. And ye that are near, acknowledge ye my might. Well, those that are far off would be any nation, any other people. And those that were near, of course, would be the ones who were in the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem. And this could even be a prophecy referring to the benefits we would get today as being afar off, or as being God's people, being those that are near, from hearing about his deeds. God expected the world to know what he'd done.